Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, two fantastic cinematographers and two fantastic films from The Wrestler, Maurice Alberti, and from Wendy and Lucy, Mr. Sam Levy. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everybody, to another great episode of Movie Geeks United. Hope everyone's doing great tonight. I'm here with Jerry.
Hey, what's
hey,
up, everyone?
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. We're going to be talking about two fantastic, like I said, the top films tonight.
Yes, very good. Very excellent character studies, both of them.
They really are, and they have a lot in common, these
they
movies.
They do.
And particularly the way they're shot. I mean, just... aesthetically, first of all, they're both shot on the 16mm format.
Right. Gritty realism.
Gritty, yeah. Yeah. And they both, and we discussed this with Mr. Levy a little bit later, they both feel like you're almost eavesdropping on these characters.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Especially, with both of them, because you feel like that in the Wrestler. Certainly the scenes in the beginning where they show him prepping all
mm-hmm.
for the match and getting ready, and also in the scenes in Wendy and Lucy, I think the whole thing is almost eavesdropping. You feel like you're a fly on the wall to this woman's travels and travails. So
they're both great movies, and they're movies that kind of feel like rarities nowadays.
Movies
that that would be the norm in something like the 70s. Here I go talking about the 70s again, but
yeah,
you know what I mean.
But it's very appropriate. It's very appropriate, the 70s. These films would definitely have been right in place in that time period. So,
mm-hmm.
And I just think, I don't think Wendy and Lucy, and I read an interview with the director in the Washington Post last week, and they had she had no idea that the film would be so appropriate for the economy right now. They weren't even really thinking that. It was based on on Hurricane Katrina was actually the genesis of that film.
Yeah. It sadly appropriate now.
Yeah.
And particularly with Wendy and Lucy, the Wrestler feels a little more, maybe not as much as your average movie, but plot driven.
Mm-hmm.
Character from point A to point B.
Right.
And that whole kind of arc. Wendy and Lucy feels like just a slice of life. I mean, it particularly feels like you're just observing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature of the script. There's no huge character changing events, but there are in a certain way. I mean,
mm-hmm.
obviously
she
goes through some profound trauma in the film.
She does, and she has to make a very painful decision, and that's something that a lot of families are actually dealing with as we speak right now. And
yeah.
I was just thinking, it does sort of almost remind me of the Dogma 95 movement that was very popular a couple of years ago, the way it's shot. It's not as austere as those films, obviously, but it does remind me a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah. And plus, they are the titles say exactly what these films are about.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you are following The Wrestler. You're following Wendy and Lucy, and that's the goal of the main goal of the films. Impossibly good films. And Michelle Williams, I don't know what happened with the buzz about her performance. Obviously, anyone that sees this film is just stunned by her performance.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It kind of left the mainstream awards talk. Not that that's the ultimate goal, but that's odd.
And yeah, it is. It really is. It's a shame because it is something that it's a film that definitely deserves a wider audience. Certainly not the easiest sell right now, but I still think there is a market for that, much wider than it's getting. And I do think just to watch her in action, because she is very good, especially when given the right material, what she'll do.
Yeah.
And here, I mean, I would have to say definitely one of the best things that she's ever done.
Yeah, it feels like a real turning point for her,
yeah,
as it does for Rourke in The Wrestler. So these are very much like tied together, these two films.
They are. They really are.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get the ball rolling here. Let's start with our terrific conversation with Maurice Alberti. She is absolutely one of the best cinematographers in the business. And Jerry, you and I have discussed some of the work that she's done. We're just awe-inspiring work.
Yes, they are.
Documentary world, stuff like Crumb and Taxi to the Dark Side and narrative films, Happiness and Velvet Goldmine and on and on and on. I mean, she really, these are challenging, important films that have something to say.
They are, absolutely.
And those are the kinds of projects she gravitates towards. I mean, she's a true artist, and this was a great conversation. So enjoy it. This is our talk with Maurice Alberti.
I grew up in the south of France. I didn't have a TV. I didn't see a TV until I was 12 years old. My grandmother had the first TV on the block, which the whole, like half of the village would go see on Wednesday night. And it was a recorded play. It was called Au Théâtre ce soir, to the theater tonight. So I just fell in love like with movies when I first came to the States, because I stayed with people who had the TV in every room, which was the most amazing thing for me. And then that was a long time ago. That was 35 years ago. And there was films, you know, The Late Show, The Late Late Show. So I was watching movies until 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's when I fell in love with movies.
What, were there movies that were a particular influence on you?
Oh, over the years after, you know, I don't know, influence, you know, but, you know, they're the classic, like, Apocalypse Now, all the Godfather movies, or Woman in the Dunes, was a black and white Japanese movie. What's this movie with Marlon Brando in France? I forgot.
Oh, the one in France.
Yes.
I know there was Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah, that's the one. That's really,
oh, amazing.
All the Bertolucci film. I mean, you know, and movies still influence me, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, then when I came to the States, you know, I took pictures of my friends in rock and roll bands. And then somehow, and I'm sure you know that, I ended up on the X-Rated movie set. Where I was the still photographer. So I did that for a few years to pay the rent, and it was sort of an amazing scene. And I have a collection of pictures from X-Rated movies that eventually I made into some artwork that I've shown in galleries. And
So how did that first job as a cinematographer or as a camera operator, how did that come into play?
I don't know. You know, when I started to work on X-rated movies, I met people. You know, that were, I mean, like the crews in New York were then like young people out of Columbia or NYU.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of the training ground. I mean, one of the training grounds. So I met people. I started to you know, since I didn't do a film school, that was kind of my film school where I'm, you know, and someone that I met introduced me to someone. And I got my first job as an assistant on the film set. And then in the meantime, I had a little Super 8 camera, so I shot little movies for my friends, you know. And I kept on working as an assistant. And I worked on documentaries a lot. I didn't like to work as an assistant on a feature film. But on documentaries, as an assistant, you get to do a little bit of lighting. You're very close to the director. You're very involved because it's a crew of 3 or 4 people.
Right.
And then eventually someone gave me a chance to shoot a documentary, and then the first full-length documentary that I shot called H2 Worker, directed by Stephanie Black, who I stayed a very good friend of mine, won Best Documentary at Sundance, and I won Best Cinematography, which was kind of a shock.
Yeah, that's terrific. So many people that we talk to, obviously it sounds like you learned by doing, by actually doing it. But so many people we talk to have that one mentor or someone that kind of guided them and taught them a lot. Was there someone like that for you?
No, I wish there had been. But yeah. I wish there had been, but there was not. there are people who gave me chances along the way, you know. Then Todd Haynes, I shot his first movie, The Poison. My first feature was The Poison. And again, that film was very controversial because there was a gay subject, and it was funded by some government fund, and there was a lot of scandal around that. So automatically, you know, it made a lot of publicity in the film. And if you do good work on a good movie, a movie that's being looked at and talked about, then, you know, again, you make a step forward. It's a little bit like what's happening now with The Wrestler. If The Wrestler was a bad movie, nobody would be talking about me. You would not be interviewing me, you know what I mean?
Sure, we would. I look at your resume, and it's amazing work. I love so much of these films.
They're great.
But such a imprint that you've had in the documentary world as well. And what's the appeal of working in that medium? I would think that you just meet the most incredible people in the most amazing situations.
Yeah, 2 years ago I did a movie called In God's Name, where we traveled all around the world and met 13 of the world religious leaders. And the highlight was I spent a week with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala in northern India, and I actually spend a week with him, you know. So yeah, you get to meet, you know, I've been down in the mines in Bolivia, and I filmed the King of Spain or Gorbachev or the Pope or the Dalai Lama. You know. I like documentary for two reasons, because it's always, I mean, the film that I have chosen and that eventually come my way, it's always an adventure, and it's always a lesson in the world, you know. You enter those little worlds that make up the big world, you know. So you learn something very intensely. Like right now I'm doing a documentary on Lance Armstrong, who is going back to try to win the Tour de France after 2 years of absence. So I'm not especially interested in cycling, but I'm in this world, and it's kind of a fascinating world. And then, like, the athleticism and, you know, that you require to do something like the Tour de France is kind of amazing, you know. So now I'm in this world. Like a couple of years ago, I did a Taxi to the Dark Side, that won an Academy Award, and you just enter the world of politics and the army and all those things that are hidden from us. And then also what happened in Abu Ghraib. So I like docs for that. And then also, you know, from a cinematographer point of view, you learn how to work with very simple tool with very few people. You know, it's not a big machine around you. It's very small. Mm-hmm. And sometimes after doing a feature where you have to deal with 100 people and deal, you know, with a lot of personality and a lot of pressure, you know, docs is it's another way of working. It's more instinctual. You know, it's less intellectual, I find. Although you want to think about the style of your documentary, but in the end, you know, I think that documentary always sort of remind me. I mean, I've been to China, India, and South America. It sort of reminds you how privileged our life is.
Yeah.
You know, and how lucky we are. And sometimes when you complain about, you know, your rate or you work long hours, which is all true, you know, sometimes you just think about that woman you've seen taking care of 3 kids with no money, was to work the field, and then you say, okay, I have it very well. I have it very good. So that's why I like the world of documentary.
We love documentaries on this show. We champion quite a few of them.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned Taxi to the Dark Side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the documentary form has done very well with covering the state of the world, particularly in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are, and whether you see that documentaries changing in the, you know, with the new administration, and it feels like kind of a new generation coming on. I know that particularly with Iraq and Afghanistan and the torture issues that you covered with Taxi to the Dark Side and other documentarians have covered
very
well.
You know, then hopefully we can go to Iraq and make a documentary about some amazing survival and rebuilding story, you know,
mm-hmm.
instead of making a documentary about an amazing, destructive and torture story, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think, you know, and then, you know, unfortunately, I mean, you know, the world is a big, big dark side, and human beings have a dark side, and nature has a dark side. So I think the documentary always going to find a story to take the dark side and the amazing you know side of human beings, you know, and
mm-hmm.
they don't all have to be dark, you know.
Yeah.
So I hope also because Obama, I know a lot of people have been campaigning to ask Mr. Obama to create a minister of culture. Which a ministry of culture, with you know, there are a lot of things like that in Europe. You know, France has a ministry
right.
of culture, and there's no such a thing in the United States. And it would be great if he, you know, if he created something like that, that really help filmmakers to get funded and to do more documentaries. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that obviously the digital revolution has really taken over
yes.
the past few years.
Yes.
Do you still prefer film, or is digital really invaluable for a documentarian, this technology now?
I think now. I mean, you know, do I still in general do I prefer film? I'm gonna answer. You know, it depends on the story. Like with The Wrestler, we thought at one point, you know, maybe mm. we should go digital. We'll work faster, it'll be cheaper. And then I really thought, you know, and I spoke with Darren. No, I think that this movie, this story, would be best be told in 16mm. You know,
yeah.
like the grain of the film. But some story are best told in a digital world. Like in documentary, I think it's a question of economics, you know. Like one of the staple of documentaries is interviews.
Right.
You know, whether you like it or not, but able to roll the camera, to roll, you know, to get that moment, you know, that tells you, you know. So I think, you know, when we did H2 Worker, which was, I don't know, 15 years ago or 18 years ago, H2 Worker is about the Jamaican farm workers who cut the sugar cane in slave camp in Florida, you know. And we went to Jamaica with 5 rolls of film because we didn't have any money. And you had to be very careful the question you ask and when you roll. And I'm glad that now, you know, you can go with a few tapes and you
mm-hmm.
can, you know, you can roll and instead of doing an interview, you can have a conversation, you know.
Right.
So I think for documentary, it makes a lot more sense. And with the new cameras, I mean, some of them look really great. I've been trying this EX3 camera that I went to look at a test, blown up to 35. It's amazing. It looks
It is,
it looks
isn't
great.
It? I mean, this... It has arrived. This it really
yeah,
has.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, of course, if you compare it to 35, it's not as sharp as you know. It's not film, but
mm-hmm.
that's not really what makes a good film. So if you can roll a little bit more, if the cameras are smaller, you know, it makes such a big difference. You know.
Well, my understanding is from reading about the preparation for The Wrestler, this is one of the reasons why Aronofsky wanted to go with you because of your documentary experience. I think one of the reasons was it was important to him to follow the lead character wherever he goes and to have that kind of openness with the lighting.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, first when I first met with Darren or first talked to him on the phone, he mentioned his big reference in the style of the film was the movies of the Dardenne brothers. You know, those guys, the Belgium... brothers who did Rosetta and The Child, and you know, if you know them, you know their style of camera is handheld and following people. And so I think because I do documentary, and you know, he was interested in working with me because also I've done very stylized movie. You know, I mean, like I've did a movie like Velvet Goldmine, but I also done documentary. So
right,
the director
right.
knows I can do a feature, I can light, but I also. You know, so I think he was interested in that, and that I was willing to work very simply sometime when, you know. And he wanted, of course, to give a lot of freedom to Mickey to move about and to improv, which we did. And, you know, often he would ask me to light so he could shoot a 360, which is a dream of a lot of directors, you know. And sometimes I could and sometimes I could not, but he's smart enough and knows enough about movies when, you know. So it was a really great collaboration. And then, you know, when I heard him say, you know, sometimes we're going to do 10 takes or 15 takes, you know, I think I had the smartness to know that it was going to be too much physically to light, to shoot a 15 take. So I hired, I find a fabulous camera operator, Peter Nolan, who did, you know, all the handheld work in the film. And it was a savior because he was really great. He's great at hand holding. And he had an amazing energy, 15, 20 takes. He was still going with great attitude. So I was very lucky to have found him.
Now you actually, talking about some of the previous work you've done and the adventures you've been on with these projects, I would take it that you knew very little about wrestling before starting the picture. What was important for you to know about the actual sport prior to working on this?
Well, you know, during the time of prep, every weekend, you know, Darren, and producer, and costume designer, and whoever wanted to go, you know, Darren is great to try to really involve and bring people along in the adventure, not as, you know, just as a job, but in an adventure. Come with me, you know. And so we made it a party every Saturday night. Went to see wrestling. And it was really good, I think, for all of us. For me, it was really good to see the world, to see, it's kind of a little bit of a traveling, the circus, to see how they travel with one set of lighting, you know, like, and to, you know, to try to keep that world as real. I mean, the whole film is at a very naturalistic look. So when we look at location and when I went to look at the wrestling match, I tried to make it work for the drama of the film, but to keep it as real as possible. So you felt that you were in a real place. And you were, because all of the match were actually part of a real promotion. The director and the producer worked with real wrestling promoters who allow us to come in a promotion and shoot Mickey in the ring once in a while. And all the wrestlers that you see in the movies are all professional wrestlers. And Mickey was trained by professional wrestlers that sometimes were in the ring with him.
Obviously, Mickey Rourke is astonishing in this movie. And I'm wondering, from your point of view, behind the lens, could you sense that this was a very profound experience for him?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that Mickey Rourke is the movie. You take Mickey out of the movie, you put somebody else, you know. And Darren was very, very smart and very brave.
So what are you doing right now?
What am I doing?
You know, I thought maybe we could, you know, stop by our old favorite place.
We have an old favorite place.
You'll recognize it when you see it.
No, now's not really the best time. I got some stuff I gotta do.
What kind of stuff?
Stuff?
Come on, I'm not gonna take a bite out of you or anything. Just, you know, hang out for a little while.
Like when I first talk about it, Nick Cage was supposed to do the movie. And the budget was twice the size, and everybody's rates was twice the size. And Darren, you know, was very smart and very brave. So, you know what? This is not the movie I want to make. This is not going to work. And it's not a reflection. I think that that Nick Cage is a very good actor. He was just not the part. And Mickey is a wrestler. His body, the history of his body, and his own story is a parallel, you know. So, you know, I thought it was a very smart choice from Darren. And Mickey, you know, he's a very good actor.
He's fantastic.
People sort of forget. We just sort of remember the bad boy, the fucked up, he disappeared. But he's a very good actor, and he worked very hard. And I mean, it was such a pleasure and a privilege to be there. Like when you film, it's kind of a theater where you're 3 feet away from the actors, you know. And it was great. The whole experience was so great. It's one of those moments where everybody was perfect. You know, the director, the producer Scott Franklin was great. Mickey was being Mickey, but he was, from the stories I've heard, he was quite well behaved and aware that it was his chance.
Yeah.
And he did it.
Oh, I've always idolized Mickey Rourke from that 80s work he's done. So I am so pleased for him. Let me ask you a question about actors.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found this quote, I believe Todd Haynes said this about you. He said, actors respond to you with a great deal of trust and affection. They sort of fall in love with you. He's talking about you. What is that relationship that you have with the actor generally?
I have a lot of respect for actors. I could never do what they do. I don't want to be in front of the camera. So I have a lot of respect, and with the respect to, I want to nurture and I want to establish a trust, you know. And I've always had a very good time, and Mickey was at the beginning. You had to set boundaries, you know, but I got to really love him, and I think he really liked me and respected me, and we had a great working relationship. I don't know. I mean, I think the first thing is calm, you know, is calm, a love and respect of actors and
right.
A respect for the craft, you know, and knowing, you know, that my job is there to work with the director so he or she can tell the stories, and to allow the actors, you know, as much a space and trust as they need to give us what's going to make a good film.
Now, some of these directors that you've worked with, you know, we've talked about the documentary form and how that translates for you into your narrative work. There are some terrific narrative directors who you've collaborated with. Are these directors different, the ones that work in regularly in both mediums in your eyes?
It's, well, someone like Michael Apted, who would do a James Bond movie and Lorelei in the Mist, and then, you know, he's in the jungle in Madagascar and he has to carry my tripod because I can't climb the hill with a camera and the tripod, you know. I think different. I don't know how to answer that. I think a lot of documentary directors would like to do movies. I don't know. And, you know, someone like Michael is a pretty special. There's not a lot like him, you know, in traveling both worlds, you know.
Yeah. There seems to just be like a tremendous versatility and curiosity about him. Particularly about him, yes, ma'am.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's why I like him as a person, too, you know. I think, you know what, his main attribute, he really cares. He really cares about the subject of his films, you know, what he's talking about. And whether he does a Hollywood movie of Gorilla in the Mist, you know, or he's... You know, I went with him and I did a film on the student of Tiananmen Square where we went underground in China, in Beijing, you know. Mm. He really cares. And I think that's also one of the essence of a good documentary filmmaker. You know, for people to give you and to trust you, you know, you have to listen. They have to feel that you care, that you're listening,
yeah.
That they are important. That's one of the, you know, the first thing of a good documentary filmmaker. To be humble, to be small, and to listen, and to tell people, I care about your story. I'm here to listen. And you not believe how many people need that in their life. And then the power of the camera. You know, I mean, at times we joke and we call it, it's a new confessional. You know, that people want to be heard. They want to be, for that moment, they want to be special. You know, and it's powerful.
Very much so. Now, do you have a secret desire? Obviously, you've done a work across the board. You're very versatile yourself, but a secret desire to do that big budget sci-fi summer movie?
My son does for me. that big budget sci-fi. You know what? If the big budget sci-fi is a good film, then yes. You know, I was talking with someone. I won't tell, but about the biggest. a budget that was ever offered to me, you know, and I just didn't get into the story. I just,
right.
you know. So, you know, for me, the big budget thing means that it's more time. It means I'm going to go away from home for 5 or 6 months. I have a son who is 15 now. So you know, to be a big budget or sci-fi, it's not enough for me to go away that long. It has
right.
to be good. I have to feel I'm doing something that I care about.
Now, the Independent Spirit Awards
mm-hmm.
are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get nervous about award shows or?
Extremely. I'm not even sure that I'm gonna go because I have a fear, like more phobia of speaking in public, and I would go to the Spirit Award if I could be sure that I didn't win. So it's like the stupidest thing. I'm sorry. I do get invited often to speak on panels, and I always feel like such a loser, you know that. I have, a fear, but, you know, like I can get a rash or my heart is beating too. It's, you know, it's a phobia. So I've never been to the Spirit Award. I won once. I was nominated another time.
Uh-huh.
In Sundance, I won twice. The first time for a HT worker, I was in such a shock. I had a rash on my neck the whole evening. And on Crumb, I just didn't go. I won somebody else to get for me. So yeah, I don't. I'm not good at that, and I wish I was better. But yeah, someone should take a Valium. So I'm just so out of it. I'm not sure it would be a good image to put out there. You know.
Well, I understand your anxiety. I understand that, but you've just done amazing work, and this is an amazing movie. And I just got to tell you, I love all of your work. And I'm kind of in awe by your resume here. So there's nothing to feel nervous about on that front. So I hope you go and you enjoy the event.
Well, thank you very much.
And I appreciate your time very much. Come back anytime you'd like in the future, and thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
All righty, that's Maurice Alberti, a terrific artist, really stunning. And up for an Independent Spirit Award next month, and we are all rooting for her here on this show. Next up, it's one of the most delicately observed films in quite some time, and I'm speaking, of course, of Wendy and Lucy, which tells the story of a young woman who takes her beloved dog, a dwindling stash of cash, and her beaten-down car on a journey for a better life. The man behind the lens of this masterwork is Sam Levy, whose indelible work gives the film a compassionate, immediate, you-are-there kind of quality. And I hope you enjoy this conversation we had with this terrific artist.
What kind of car are we talking about?
It's an Accord, 1988. It's right over there.
Well, easy enough to replace serpentine belt. I don't know why the ignition won't fire, though. Who knows? Could be the timing belt.
How much did the new serpentine belt?
Oh, $100, $125. Depends on if we have to order a new one. I'll have to check stock. And be $50 for labor. That's the best you'll find, I promise that.
Okay, and what about a timing belt? How much is that?
It could be a little bit more, but I won't know until I have a look.
Okay.
And we're going to have to tow it over, I guess. That adds another $50.
But it's just right there.
Well, it's always $50, but there's no mileage here, so it's just $50.
The first film or video that I ever worked on was when I was in high school, and I used to do theater. I was an actor, like a high school, junior high and high school actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first love, was doing theater. And a friend of mine used to videotape stuff, and he'd play around with, at that time, a half-inch VHS video camera. And then he started making these little short videos, and he'd have me be in them. And we had a lot of fun doing that. And basically, when I went on to college, where I was a literature student, I was a comparative literature student. I had an extra course my second year of college, and there was a filmmaking production class, and I just sort of thought, why not go for it? I talked to the teacher, and I dug up some of these old videos that I had participated in, and convinced her to let me join her 16 millimeter film production class. And from there, it's just sort of took it and ran.
At that point, you knew that it was a cinematography that interested you.
What happened was I studied with this fantastic woman. I studied at Brown University as a comparative literature student at Brown. And I took a fantastic film course there with a woman named Leslie Thornton, who's an experimental filmmaker and a real genius and inspiration and mentor of mine. But anyways, I was in her class, which was really kind of slanted towards the experimental, which was a great way to start out,
right,
and not sort of narrative filmmaking. And it was in making short films in this class that I very quickly figured out that I loved the kind of photographic side of what we were doing. And the thing was, I'd never done any still photography or anything like that. Most of the other students in the class, I'd say just about all of them, had handled, you know, a 35 millimeter film camera and understood about shutter speeds and how to use a light meter. I didn't know any of that. So it was sort of, in the beginning, you know, I started to really fall in love with just being behind the camera and that sort of thing. And at first I thought, well, I haven't been prepared. I just didn't think like that. But the teacher, Leslie, was very encouraging about these things. And one thing led to another, and I decided to try to get a summer job that summer in the film business. And I ended up getting an internship here in New York at a commercial production company and found my way onto a set. And I was at that moment, when I was on my first real movie set, although it was for a commercial, that my eyes gravitated right towards the DP, towards the cinematographer, and then also at the camera assistants that were kind of buzzing around him.
Right.
It was a DP named Fred Murphy, the guy who shot Hoosiers and many, many great films. And he just seemed like this kind of mystical person. I knew what a cinematographer was, but I'd never actually seen one in action. And it was a big American Express commercial, actually. And it just seemed like a fantastic thing. And I looked right at him, and I thought, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, but when you were conscious of cinematography and you knew that direction you wanted to take with your life, did you start looking at films differently, and what DPs were most influential to you just by viewing their work?
Well, it's a great question. That same summer, when I was on the set with Fred Murphy, it was the same summer that the film Visions of Light came out in theaters.
Yeah.
So it was this sort of very, eye-opening time, and I went to the theaters and saw Visions of Light, where, they talk about all these great DPs like Gordon Willis and Vittorio Storaro, Owen Roizman, and some of the, older school DPs like Arthur Miller and.
Right.
Orson Welles' DP on Citizen Kane, Greg...
Toland, yeah.
Greg Toland.
I love the scene in that movie. They're talking about In Cold Blood and the raindrops running down Robert Blake's face. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up with that part of that documentary.
It's great.
That's a great one.
And that same thing happened to me sitting there in that theater watching that. And I'd already decided that's what I wanted to do. But I walked out of the theater sort of very inspired. But aside from that documentary, I would say almost from the get-go, when I once I'd already started to watch movies prior to actually taking this course and dragging out in the film business. The first two filmmakers I really started to look at movies differently were Kurosawa and Ingmar Bergman. I watched those movies, and then once I started to become become more interested in cinematography, it was really Gordon Willis's work that that just stood out above everything else to me, no matter what it was. The first thing I really studied was the first two Godfather films. But right. then once I learned that he existed, and that he was the work was special, and in addition to it being special, he was this interesting risk-taking character who, the more I worked in the business, the more I'd hear these mythological stories about him. But then I started to see saw films like The Parallax View and Woody, the Woody Allen movies he did, particularly Interiors, which just a fantastic work of cinematography to me. And
that's interesting too, because you have some very you started from experimental filmmaking, and you have some very experimental credits to your name, and Gordon Willis is somebody like that. Where in some of the biggest films like a Godfather 2. I mean, he's really experimenting and pushing what is possible with that work.
Yeah. He's doing that, which is incredible. Once you start to understand the technical properties of what he was doing, it's amazing. But moreover, what's amazing is just what the work does for the films and for the stories. It really serves the stories so well, and it's really breathtaking. But it's not ostentatious or gaudy, and it doesn't stand out. It doesn't distract. If anything, it just helps the viewer engage. Which is just, that's everything in cinematography no matter what it is, whether it's an experimental film, whether it's a nonlinear narrative or the most traditional linear type of narrative, I think, cinematography in some way can be many different ways is really should just help the viewer engage in some way or another. You should hold the viewer's interest.
Yeah.
And not, distract in some sort of, in that same regard.
Let's talk a little bit about Wendy and Lucy. I understand that you really campaigned for this one. How did you get a hold of the script, and what were those initial impressions?
Well, the first person to call me for the script was one of the executive producers, who is also a director, named Phil Morrison, who directed Junebug. He was the first person to call me. Kelly Reichardt had been preparing the film almost from the moment she finished up her previous film, Old Joy.
Right.
And she started prepping and was looking for someone. And Phil called me and asked if I was interested, and I hadn't even seen a script. I didn't know anything about Wendy and Lucy, which at that time was called Train Choir, and was through the entire production until later. But just on the strength of Old Joy, I was very interested, and I practically said, I'll commit right now. I'd love to do the director of Old Joy's next movie.
Yeah.
I was actually in an airport. I was going to North Carolina to shoot a commercial. And when I got that phone call, I was waiting to check in line. And before I even got to the front of the line, I concluded that phone call with Phil. And Kelly then called me probably several minutes later. We spoke a little bit. She explained that it was she was looking for someone, and they were going to start fairly soon. I think it was probably you know, maybe a month away. I basically then and there said, I'm interested. I'd love to see the script, but, you know, I'm very interested. It sounds fantastic. They sort of explained a little about the story. And I think that night they sent me the script, but I had already decided in my mind that, you know, I was in. If they wanted me, I was in. And what sort of happened was I flew to North Carolina to work on this commercial, and I read the script and basically said, it's fantastic. I'd love to be this movie's DP. And, you know, I'd been planning to go. I live in New York City, and I was planning to go back to New York after the commercial. But instead, you know, what Kelly said was, you sound great. I'd like to do this, but it's tough. You know, it's tough to hire someone when you haven't actually met them, which I totally understood. And so I said, well, why don't I? She was in Portland at that moment, Portland, Oregon, where the movie was shot. And I suggested, well, why don't I just come out to Portland in a few days when I'm done with this commercial? And she said, oh, no, you know, I couldn't pay for your flight. I said, that's all right. You know, I'll pay for my flight. So I came out, and she and her producer, a different producer, picked me up at the airport. And we basically, that day, we almost started scouting immediately. Dropped my bags off at an apartment that they had rented for me. We scouted. We had a few conversations, and we didn't really talk about. You know, it got to the end of the day, and we were sort of about. They were going to drop me off at the apartment, and I said, "Well, I just got to ask you guys. Is you know, am I your DP?" And Kelly, very funny. Kelly said, "Oh no, we're not letting you leave." So at that point it was official, which was great.
Yeah.
So I just stayed in Portland. I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to New York, then I'll come back. But it became clear very quickly that there was, you know, I really had to do the movie the right way and to do right by Kelly. I really had to stay. So, it turned from this, you know, going to North Carolina for a couple of days, for 4 days maybe, to do a commercial to, you know, it turned into a 3-month trip where I didn't return back to New York City. Almost
wow.
3 months.
Wow. Tell me what is special about that area of Oregon as it pertains to this movie. Why does it work so well for this particular story in your eyes?
Well, I should start by answering that question by saying that I'd never been to Portland, Oregon before.
Mm-hmm.
Before I flew out there to meet Kelly and then to shoot this movie. So to me, what was special is it's, you know, Portland's a wonderful, vibrant, yet small city with a fantastic community. And, you know, as a person who lives in New York City, which is, you know, very dense, concrete, vertical world, it just seemed to have, you know, you know, there was a lot of space, and was warm, and you know, it's not as frantic, and just a different energy. You know, it's Pacific Northwest. There's just a different vibe to the culture out there, which was completely new to me. So I was very sensitive to that. You know, Kelly had just, you know, her last movie prior to Wendy and Lucy was Old Joy, which was also shot in and around Portland.
Right.
So to her, there was a lot of, you know, it was the Wendy and Lucy thing, no matter how you slice it, was an extension of that prior movie in Portland. For me, it was, the whole thing was new. Well, working with Kelly was new. Shooting a movie in Portland was new. So aside from that, Portland is a fantastic place to shoot a movie because it's a very friendly place to shoot a movie, particularly one that's an independent movie with, you know, a limited budget, which Wendy and Lucy is. It was, it's a small movie. We shot it in 20 days. We had a decent amount of locations, and we relied heavily on the community there to, you know, for locations and for, you know, things like that. And it just always felt like it's such a supportive community. We had a fantastic location manager, Roger Fares, who, you know, for everybody it was a labor of love and with no attitude. And I was amazed. I was amazed that just how friendly people were, and it somehow translates into the locations in the film that you see. Even though it's a sad story about a person, about a woman who's down on her luck, but to me there's a luscious quality to a lot of those locations that I just sensed, you know, in Portland itself. And since, again, it was so new to me, I was it's a place that made me happy. And everyone who worked on the movie, except for Kelly, who is from New York City also, everyone, the crew, were all people from Portland. So what was great was we weren't just there filming in Portland. We were working with people who live in Portland and are part of the community. And it was just a wonderful new experience to be with these great people who are so passionate about the project and believed in it as much as I did and believed in Kelly as much as I did. And because of Old Joy and just because of friends that she has there, Kelly is a very beloved person in Portland. And all of that went into the making of the movie.
What was the kind of direction that she wanted to take with the camera? What were those conversations?
Well, Kelly, first of all, you know, Kelly has an amazing eye. She's an incredible visual director, and just in basic sense of composition and blocking and extending into mise-en-scène and the way she directs, she has a great sense of how things will play out visually and in a way that I love. It's a subtle execution, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just sort of her way of working. The first things that we did to, you know, the first things that she did to explain the visual approach was to, you know, we watched a few movies just to discuss them. We watched Pather Panchali by Satyajit Ray. We watched Mouchette by Robert Bresson. We watched a few other things, and through that, it just helped. Since we had just met basically for the first time, it just helped us start to develop a language. One of the first things that she talked about was the use of medium shots. And in a way to capture the character of Wendy. And that was one thing that came out of our discussions of looking at Robert Bresson's work. And it was she never showed me anything, and we never aped anything or copied anything. It was never like that. But she just talked about utilizing medium shots. And it was as simple as that, but the way that she described it was just sort of like you could tell that she didn't have an arbitrary, random approach to how the story was going to be photographed and how it was going to be blocked. And in other words, like Kelly isn't the kind of person to approach a scene and just sort of hose it down, as they say, or, you know, do a lot of coverage and figure it out later. She figures it out as it's being blocked in an amazing, very efficient way. That was clear even just in our beginning discussions. And she was always sure about where the camera should go, where the actor should go. And so a lot of times I was just really reacting to that, to her absolute certainty of how things should work. And
yeah. Do you have a favorite kind of moment from the film? And also, when you view the film, are you able to separate the experience of viewing it from the experience of what you shot that day?
I'll answer the first question.
Okay.
off the top of my head, there's one favorite moment. Is that kind of the question?
Yes.
Their favorite moment?
Yeah.
I think there's a few moments that I really like, but I'd say just off the top of my head, my favorite moment is the moment when Wendy calls home to her sister and her brother-in-law, and the scene, it's just one shot. It's, you know, Kelly Reichert at her best. There's no coverage. It's all one shot, basically a medium. And we were inside of a shop looking at her on a payphone through glass, and there's all kinds of great reflections on the glass. And I like that moment. It was initially we were going to try and do it during the day or at dusk, and then the sun fell. I did have to illuminate Michelle a little bit, and this thing that to me just is really great happened. All these cars are going by and reflections on the window, and yet to me it's not too obtrusive, and I'm just very happy with that moment.
Now that you said that, the way it was shot through the store window, at times it seems it is a very unobtrusive camera. And at times it feels like it's almost eavesdropping on her, you know, following her through this experience.
That was the intent, was to give it that feeling so that, you know, the way you look at her isn't to, you don't think about it too much. It is as if you're just watching things unfold.
Right, right. It's beautiful, beautiful.
And then the answer to your second question, you know, is it hard to separate? Can I just watch the movie?
Right.
I would say at first it was very hard for me to just watch the movie. When I saw the first edit, when Kelly sort of had picture locked it, and I saw it, and my first instinct was, I like it. I really like it. But a million thoughts were bouncing around in my head, and then it premiered at Cannes, and that was the first time we saw it with an audience, and I still felt the same way. I was just sort of taking it in. I thought I really like it, but I still don't know what I'm watching. And then there was a great moment that was very satisfying where it premiered in the U.S. at the New York Film Festival at the Ziegfeld, which was great. And we'd gotten the print to a place that we were really happy with, that I was really thrilled with. And at that moment, I was able to just sort of kick back and enjoy it. The best thing was that Kelly seemed really happy with the movie. And you know, I respect her so much, the director. That was, you know, she had a smile on her face. I felt like I'd done my job in some way. And at that moment, she was happy. I was happy with the print, and my mom was there, some friends there, and it was great. That was probably the first time I watched it and felt relaxed, and just sort of took it in. Of course, I'd seen it many times, knew the movie very well, but I felt like I was watching it in the most objective sort of way for the first time that evening.
Yeah. Well, it is a beautiful film, and you did beautiful work on it. And Sam, thank you, buddy, for calling
no
in. And
I'm
call
glad
back
you like
anytime.
It. Thanks.
I love it, man. Thank you, sir.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye, Sam.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. That is Mr. Sam Levy. The movie is Wendy and Lucy. We highly recommend that you check that film out. It's a terrific piece of work. And earlier we spoke to Maurice Alberti. Her movie is The Wrestler. I believe that's in wide release now, and it's a major Oscar contender. There's a lot of buzz about Mickey Rourke, obviously, in this film, and it's one of the great performances. You got to check that one out, too, if you haven't already. All right, that wraps things up for Movie Geeks United tonight. It's been a wonderful show. I thank everyone out there for listening. Tune in next week because we got some great stuff upcoming. Two independent films this weekend that we'll be covering, Donkey Punch and Courting Condi. That's quite a combo right there. And then next Wednesday we have two Oscar nominees for makeup, John Caglione from The Dark Knight and Mr. Mike Elizalde from Hellboy. And don't forget about our February 11th show, a two-hour epic on the Friday the 13th series featuring up to a dozen cast and crew members from the original series and the upcoming reimagining. It is a great time to be a movie geek. Thanks so much, everybody. You guys have a great night.